When earlier this year I heard about Denmark's queen abdicating her throne, I realized that I didn't really know much about Denmark, about its history.
It never occurred to me until I read Cicely Wedgwood's book on the 30 Years' War that Denmark ever actually wielded any kind of influence. I knew it was Sweden.
Office,
but wasn't aware of Denmark. And so this was, my mind was blown, and I immediately just pursued it from there. And that's, Denmark is largely overlooked in the grand narrative we have of pre-modern Europe. He said, I'm curious, you're an American, why would you find any of this interesting? The interesting history is where you live. And there's this, and I found this again and again, except from professional historians in Denmark, is they really didn't think their history was all that interesting. Temple might demand a pretty high fee, but this money goes directly to the king's coffers, not to Denmark's, but to the king's. And it means that Danish kings have a tremendous amount of wherewithal. Christian IV, king of Denmark, from 1596 to 1648, the king during the 30 Years' War, is generally considered to be the wealthiest individual sovereign in all of Europe in terms of his access to cash reserves coming from the sound dues. There's a lot of things in Danish royal tradition, including the informality and the approachability of the dynasty as it exists today. Clearly, the Danish monarchy is a somewhat different atmosphere to it than, say, the British.
Yeah.
That these things stem from very old Germanic tribal the conditions of Germanic tribal chieftains in late antiquity. That there's a certain amount of egalitarianism there and approachability. Believed in the idea that there is a Catholic conspiracy to subjugate Protestant Europe. The language sounds a lot like domino theory when it comes to communism during the Cold War. If France falls, then it's going to be the Netherlands. Then it's going to be the Protestant German states. Then it's going to be us. And lost a fair chunk of its territory in the southern part of Jutland, which some of which they got back in 1920 after a plebiscite after World War I. But 1864 was a big slap in the face and was a national humiliation, but also a very cold reminder that Denmark isn't all that anymore.
Did you know that in the year 1600, going on to 1625, Denmark was Europe's leading Protestant state, even more important than England under the Tudors. But by 1645, Denmark was looking like it has been. This is the story of the swift decline of empire, a story that holds lessons for us Americans. Hey there, news peelers. Today is March 27, 2024, and this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink or both and let's get into it. On January 14, 2024, Margrethe II, Queen of Denmark, voluntarily abdicated her throne in favor of her 55-year-old son, whose title now is Frederick X. According to many news sources, her announcement of her decision to abdicate stunned her nation. But her case is not that unusual. Elderly monarchs in Spain, the Netherlands, and Belgium have also voluntarily given up their crowns in favor of their younger generations. The 83-year-old Danish queen reigned from January 14, 1972 to January 14, 2024, 52 years to the day. By comparison, Queen Elizabeth II's reign, which lasted until her death, was 70 years and about 7 months. I generally knew that Denmark's monarchy is less formal. It has less pomp and ceremony, for example. Unlike the United Kingdom, Denmark doesn't even have a coronation ceremony. So when I looked into the history of Queen Margrethe and Denmark, I discovered lots of cool stuff, and I'm using the word cool intentionally here. For example, I learned that Queen Margrethe's artwork was actually used in The Lord of the Rings, which is my favorite fantasy novel. It's an epic book series, and as the story goes, in 1970, J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, received her artwork in fan mail when Margrethe was Denmark's crown princess. Another cool factor is this. Have you ever thought where the logo for Bluetooth technology comes from? Just look up the logo on your phone. That strange-looking symbol stands for the letters H and B. In runic alphabet, which was the writing system native to Germanic languages, the letter H and B stand for Harald Bluetooth, the king who united the Danish tribes into one kingdom. The analogy is that Bluetooth technology would unite all devices. Now, mixing tech, startups, and history, that's pretty cool stuff. And there's so much more about Denmark's history that we Americans don't know. From its language and culture, to its Viking age, to its imperial power and major influence in European politics, and to its rapid decline. So, to learn more about Denmark, I spoke with Dr. Paul Douglas Lockhart, a professor of history at Wright State University. He teaches courses in military history, early modern Europe, and Scandinavia in its Age of Greatness. In 2022, he was elected to membership in the Royal Society for Danish History in recognition of his contributions to the study of Danish history, which is a rare accolade for a foreign scholar. He is the author of several books, two of which we discuss in this episode. First, Denmark, 1513 to 1660, the rise and decline of a Renaissance monarchy. Second, Frederick II and the Protestant cause, Denmark's role in the Wars of Religion, 1559 to 1596. To learn more about Dr. Lockhart and his extensive research, you can visit his academic and personal homepages, the links for which are provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Lockhart and I peel the history behind this news. In this episode, you'll hear my guest mention Sweden quite a bit. But did you know that Sweden has not been in war for about 210 years? Let me repeat that. Sweden has not been involved in a war in more than two centuries. That's longer than any country I can think of. It's certainly longer than Switzerland's record of peace. And did you know that the name of the country of Russia most likely came from Sweden during the Age of the Vikings? I learned these facts and much more about Sweden's fascinating history in my conversation with Professor Ulf Zander of Lund University in Sweden. I've dropped a link to that conversation below. Now, let's start our conversation with Dr. Lockhart about Denmark. Dr. Lockhart, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
In anticipation of this conversation with you, I reviewed one of your books, which is titled Denmark 1513 to 1660, The Rise and Decline of a Renaissance Monarchy. And I discovered something amazing for me anyway, that tiny little Denmark, as we look at it on the map now, was at one time one of the largest states in Europe. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. So go ahead. I'm very curious to start by talking about what is Denmark, or what was Denmark actually, the realm and the geography?
Well, and that's a good question. Of course, it also depends upon how you define Denmark within, because even the modern kingdom of Denmark, of course,
Within the modern kingdom?
Well, within the modern kingdom of Denmark, the portion that we call Denmark is actually quite small, because the vast majority of Danish territory is Greenland, which is part of the monarchy. Well, granted, it's an autonomous is an autonomous part of the monarchy. I mean, it's essentially self-governing and has been for several decades. But the Denmark itself, the Jutland Peninsula and the two main island groups, the central island group around the island of Fyn and the eastern island group around the island of Sjælland, which is where Copenhagen is located, and the island of Bornholm further east in the Baltic, are, you know, quite small because that's where the vast majority of the population is located.
Now, it's about 5 million or so, right?
Yeah, I think it's about that. It's probably about that right now, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
That, yeah. And because they, you know, the disproportionately large portion of that is in Copenhagen itself, which is a world-class city, but it's I used to drive across Denmark a lot, and especially when working in Jutland, and with the bridge built over the Great Belt between the island of Shetland and Fyn, it's, you know, it's a 3.5-hour drive to get from one end of Denmark to the other. You know,
wow.
It's
so
really short.
Very small. So let's talk about the other geographical parts of Denmark now. You mentioned Greenland and some of the islands in the peninsula in the Baltic region itself. Any more?
The Faroe Islands. I mean, currently the Faroe Islands, which were like Iceland, were a holdover from Denmark's former rule over Norway. Yeah, both Faroe Islands and Iceland were Norwegian vassal states. When Denmark lost Norway in 1814, it held on to those. Iceland was a separate monarchy within the Danish monarchy for a time until 1944, of course, when Iceland set up shop on its own, and it's been a sovereign nation since 1944.
I like how you describe that, set up shop on its own. So let's go back to the original sort of question, the awe moment that I had. Again, one of the largest states in Europe. When was that?
At the height of its power, which would have been roughly the early part of the 16th century to the middle of the 17th. I mean, this is the point at which Denmark could claim some significance as a not just as a great regional power within the Nordic Baltic section of Europe, but also as a major player on a European stage, and a major actor, front rank actor, really, in the late 16th, early 17th centuries. And that's, you know, one of the reasons I started doing Danish history, because this was, you know, I'd gone to Purdue to study military history with Gunther Offenberg, and I was fixed on the 18th century. And very first book I read on the 30 Years' War, first year I was an undergraduate, talked about Denmark's role in the 30 Years' War, and this never occurred to me until I read Cicely Wedgwood's book on the 30 Years' War, that Denmark ever actually wielded any kind of influence. I knew it was Sweden. Office, but wasn't aware of Denmark, and so this was, my mind was blown, and I immediately just pursued it from there. And that's, you know, Denmark is largely overlooked in the, you know, the grand narrative we have of pre-modern Europe.
Of course, yeah, it blew my mind when I read that passage about being one of the largest states in Europe. You said something that I wanted to go back to. You mentioned Norway. Talk to me about this a little bit. Where Norway and or Sweden at one point sort of a collective sovereignty with Denmark? I'd love to hear
several different points. Of course, you know, understand before I go into that the cultural and linguistic similarities between Denmark, Norway, and Sweden are much, much greater than the differences. It's possible Danes and Swedes can understand each other's languages with some difficulty, but the last names of the leading families of the realm in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, you know, for much of the early modern period, are the same. I mean, they're essentially the same families.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot in common there, despite, you know, modern day stereotypes about how often, you know, Norwegians and Swedes say that Danes speak like they have potatoes in their mouths, or that the language is a pathological condition of the larynx. rather than an actual language. A lot of that's just friendly, you know, friendly local rivals.
Who says that about whom? Swedes say that
about the Danes. Danish language is not enunciated anywhere near as clearly as Norwegian or Swedish. So that's
that's so funny.
Reasoning behind that. I remember when I first I visited Copenhagen in 1988 as a graduate student working on my dissertation, I saw a poster that reads, I wish I'd taken a photo at the time, "Keep our city clean, escort a Swede to the ferry." The ferry, the ferry to Sweden.
Okay.
A lot of Swedes would come over, you know, for less expensive beer. In Copenhagen. So anyway, you know, despite all that, there's really a lot similar between the three. And the history of one is so invariably caught up with the history of the others. Where it comes specifically to Denmark as a political entity, two things in particular that are especially important. One of them is the Kalmar Union, which is formalized in 1397. The Kalmar Union is which is brought to be under Queen Margrethe the First, the recent queen was
named.
Shares the name, yes. And that lasts formally until Sweden essentially forcibly ejects itself in the 1520s. But it's a personal dynastic union. In other words, it was a matter of the sovereign of Denmark was also the sovereign of Norway and the sovereign of Sweden.
Kind of like inherited the realm.
Yes. In other words, they're still three separate states. But kind of like Scotland and England, when James Stuart becomes King James the First of England, he's still King James the Sixth of Scotland. I mean, they're two separate roles, and it doesn't mean that the states are actually unified.
Or like when William the Orange of Orange or something like that became King of England as well, but he still had the Netherlands.
Right. Still had as a separate identity.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Now the union falls apart there. In the 1520s, but the 1520s, 1530s are a major period of consolidation and transition in all the Scandinavian realms, but especially in Denmark. There's a civil war in the mid 1530s, referred to as the Count's War, where the heir apparent from the ruling Oldenborg dynasty fights a civil war to maintain control of his realms, and at the same time introduces the Lutheran faith. So this is where a Protestantism begins in Denmark officially. But part of that transition is that Sweden is gone, but Norway is still tied to Denmark, and in fact, its reluctance to embrace the man who will become King Christian III in 1534.
King of Norway or King of...
King of Denmark.
Denmark. Okay.
But also, you know, he perceives himself certainly as King of Norway, is that he makes himself King of Norway in fact as well as in theory. And in fact, under Danish rule initially, you know, the historians very often refer to this union as being Denmark-Norway. And it's not exactly accurate, because Norway is reduced as a punishment for not immediately accepting the king to the status of a province. So it has no more constitutional standing than Jutland. The administration in Copenhagen rules it all. So from that point until Denmark declines significantly in the 1650s and 1660s, late 1650s in particular. The kings of Denmark rule Denmark itself. With a question mark where it comes to the southern border, I can return to that. Norway, but it's more than modern Norway. There are a couple of provinces that are taken away from Norway by Sweden later on. So it's a really large Norway. The southern tip of modern day Sweden, the provinces of Blekinge, Halland, and Skåne, which was probably the wealthiest part of Sweden, the best farmland in all of Sweden, was under Danish rule. And with Norway came Iceland and the Faroe Islands. So there's a whole lot of territory there. Plus, the Oldenburg kings of Denmark were also German princes, and Christian III, who becomes king in between 1534 and 36, was also duke of much of what today we call Schleswig and Holstein. So Denmark, the kings of Denmark ruled a pretty big chunk of German territory, plus modern-day Denmark, plus a big, probably the most valuable part of southern Sweden, and all of Norway and Iceland and the Faroe Islands.
I want to talk to you about how Denmark became so powerful and then how it lost all that power. But before we go there, let's talk about Denmark's dynasty, sure. Which was on the news recently when Queen Margaret abdicated, and now Frederick X is their king. As I understand it, Denmark's royal family, correct me if I'm wrong, is the longest uninterrupted monarchy in Europe?
So the royal family has changed a couple of times, but the monarchy itself has gone uninterrupted since the, at least as far as we can tell, from the reign of Gorm the Old.
When was that?
Middle of the 10th century.
So we're talking 900s.
Yeah.
How is that different, let's say, than England? In England, you had the parliamentary rule for some, 10, 15 years, I guess, where Charles I was beheaded in the middle of it.
Yeah. And then a protectorate under Cromwell.
Exactly. So is that a sort of thing that you would categorize as interruption?
Yes, they're interregna. You know, and Denmark doesn't really have an interregnum in its history. It's fairly, there's a couple of rough successions, but they're not they're nothing substantial. Certainly nothing compared to the Commonwealth and Protectorate in England.
Did Denmark's royal family, and I know there are several different dynasties based on what you just shared with me, did they ever mix with royal families of other cultures?
Okay. And of course, that's kind of the norm, isn't it? Where it comes to European royalty and throughout the pre-modern and modern eras. Couple in particular, England, where there are several English consorts in Denmark and Danish consorts in England. Prince George in the early late 17th, early 18th centuries, and in England, and I'm drawing a blank on what I was going to say. Greece, of course, is another one, and they're recent and older. One of the sons of Christian IX, in fact, becomes Prince George of Greece. Prince Wilhelm in Denmark, Prince George in Greece, who rules until 1913 when he's assassinated. And one of the youngest daughter of Frederick IX, Margaret's father, married the last king regnant of Greece until the monarchy was abolished there.
Interesting. Greece had the royal ties to a lot of countries, including
England. Denmark.
Yeah. So
with Denmark, in fact, so Christian IX, who was king from 1863 until 1906, a good long length of time, had the nickname the father-in-law of Europe, because his children were all married, almost all his children married off into royal families.
When in the case of Denmark, when you marry someone, when the royal family marries someone from Greece, we're going to get into religion later, but I'm just wondering, Denmark being decidedly Protestant, and then let's say you bring Orthodox Christians from Greece, does that create issues?
It doesn't create issues in Denmark. I'm trying to remember. I honestly can't remember Margrethe's sister, Anne-Marie of Greece. I can't remember what her personal arrangement was in Greece in terms of religion.
I see.
But it certainly doesn't, Denmark is a pretty secular and open society,
especially in modern era
religion. Oh yes.
My last question on the dynasty of Denmark royalty is this: I read somewhere that Denmark had elected monarchy. Yes. Do I have that correctly?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, until 16, well, the last elected monarch is Christian IV, who's king during the 30 Years' War. His son, his successor, Frederick III, is also elected, but he also imposes the royal law of 1660, 1661, which creates the hereditary monarchy. What it means is this, and it really stems from a lot of things in Danish royal tradition, including the informality and the approachability of the dynasty as it exists today. Because clearly, the Danish monarchy is a somewhat different atmosphere to it than, say, the British.
Yeah.
That these things stem from very old Germanic tribal the conditions of Germanic tribal chieftains in late antiquity. That there's a certain amount of egalitarianism there and approachability. And where it comes to election, again, this is kind of following old Germanic and Viking trends that kings are elected, but not by the populace at large. You're not talking about overall election, but rather by the leading aristocrats of the realm.
Is it similar to how the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth had elected kings for some time?
It seems to be a little bit more... less fraught with instability.
Exactly. That's why I asked that question. Yeah.
It rarely, they're rarely big issues. I mean, there are occasional, for example, by the 17th century, by the 16th century, the election is almost a formality. In other words, it's already pretty much decided. The Danes have already settled on hereditary succession. And the eldest son very often is pre-elected. While still quite young, before adolescence even, and then they're given the title the elected prince, as opposed to duke, which is a title that most younger Danish royalty would have. So they're already kind of slated for this, and the election itself, which precedes the coronation, is kind of a formality. But there's a couple of important caveats there. One of them is that it can be a point of contention. And this is, for example, in the 17th century, the transition to the succession of King Frederick III, the son of Christian IV, because the aristocracy was very upset with his father. They had him in a very difficult position because Christian IV, eldest son, predeceased Christian IV. And so the aristocracy found an opportunity to extract some concessions if you want your second son elected.
Oh, interesting. So again, the point that you're making is that this is not a democracy. This is not popular elections. No. You made the point, you said the word aristocracy several times. So this is essentially the lords and the barons, what have you, whatever those names are.
A couple dozen people.
There you go. Exactly. We'll be back after a short break to talk about Vikings and Denmark's military power. We Americans speak English, of course. But have you ever wondered, why is it that we don't speak Turkish? You're probably saying, Adele, this is one of the weirdest questions you've ever asked in this program. And you're probably right. But my question won't sound so weird or silly if you take a moment and think about what the world looked like in the late 15th century and throughout the 16th century. The superpower of the world back then was the Ottoman Empire. It was a behemoth that occupied most of the Middle East, all of North Africa, and a big chunk of Eastern Europe. So my question is, why didn't this superpower, the Ottoman Empire, with its vast resources, explore and colonize the world and colonize the Americas? Why is it that instead of the Ottoman Empire, smaller European kingdoms, with their limited resources, explore and then colonize the Americas? The short answer is that the Ottomans didn't need to explore the Americas. But the long answer, the one told by my guest in Unraveling the Middle East podcast, is much more fascinating.
In this two-part episode, Dr. Alan Mikhail of Yale University talks about how Europeans called Montezuma a sultan, referred to Aztec structures as mosques, and described American native women as wearing Moorish dresses. And he tells us about one sultan, a real sultan, who doubled the size of the Ottoman Empire in just a few years and implemented changes that still shape our world today. I've dropped a link to my conversation with Dr. Mikhail in the Unraveling the Middle East podcast. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Lockhart about Denmark.
Dr. Lockhart, what role did Denmark play in the Viking Age?
That's a good question. I'm not sure how to answer it in that way, except that the Viking Age is a critical point in Danish history because it witnesses two major developments there. One of them is the creation of Denmark as a monarchy, because up until that point, like much of Germanic Europe that had been beyond Roman horizons in late antiquity, Denmark and the Scandinavian lands and England, for that matter, are kind of a chaotic jumble of competing Germanic groups. Mm-hmm. With Denmark, it seems to be that under the height of Viking power in the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, especially, we see actually some centralization. In fact, Gorm the Old really is part of this, part of the Viking Age, and it's during that time that we see Denmark as a Viking kingdom creating something like an empire for the first time, and in particular its incursions into England in the 10th and 11th centuries. So this is a critical time. The other development besides the creation of the monarchy is the introduction of Christianity, which happens primarily under Gorm the Old's son. Remember, Gorm is he's not the first king of Denmark. He's the first king of Denmark that we can positively identify. There's a legendary, the succession of legendary kings before him.
Like mythical?
Well, not so much mythical as that they're attested to by foreign sources that had fleeting contact with him. And you don't really know from the Danes themselves, from written records. What the political situation was really.
Your primary research sources don't come from Denmark itself. Right. They come from other nations that interact
with them. Charlemagne, from Carolingian contacts, for example.
There you go.
With the Danes.
The Franks, the French.
So we know about Frankish contacts with kings in what would be Denmark, as to what the extent of their authority was. We really, really can't say very well.
I wanted to get some clarification on something you said. You said the Viking Age did two things. The second thing that you said was religion. But the first thing that I want to ask you about is you said established monarchy, and this is when Denmark was becoming an empire, and they encroached into England. As I understand it, they even ruled parts of England or all of it for some time. How do I ask this question? What I want to know is, was that an empire, sort of a well-established empire with bureaucracy and institutions, or was it more like tribal warriors conquering lands?
It's more like that. More like the latter. Yeah. It's more like it's an outpost, and certainly, I don't think anybody could accuse the early Danish kings of having any kind of significant functioning bureaucracy. Not until somewhat later in the Middle Ages when that definitely does emerge. The term empire there, I should have practically put in quotes. The Danes are ruling over lands that are not Denmark, even if only fleetingly. It's not an empire in the way that we would perceive an empire in the 16th century or certainly in the 19th century.
Yeah. And there are a lot of, and this is not exclusive to Danes. For example, Attila the Hun established an empire, but, you know, it went away, or Tamerlane had an empire. Many, many of these very powerful warriors established such a quote-unquote empires. So let's talk about, go back to your book again, Denmark, 1513 to 1660, the rise and decline of a Renaissance monarchy. So when did Denmark become a major military power?
It would be the mid to late 16th century. And all it was building as soon as Christian III, the king I was mentioning, who brought in, you know, brought in Protestantism formally in the last man standing at the end of the so-called Counts War in 1536. With Christian III's accession in 1536, there's a definite shift in power dynamics within the Danish state. I mean, the king wields a lot more authority than he had before. Partly this is a function of Protestantism, because the king has essentially claimed all lands that once belonged to the church. And the church has become the spiritual, you know, servant of the monarchy. Especially Lutheranism was a huge boon, you know, to ambitious monarchs. It really allowed them the opportunities to grab power that they hadn't been able to do before. And we certainly see this at work in Denmark, where the king goes from being a minor landowner to the major landowner. But with Christian III, Christian III overtly tried to avoid entanglements on the European continent. After all, he was German in language, by birth, and by inclination, but he tried to steer clear of the religious wars that were already, you know, starting to brew in the Holy Roman Empire and elsewhere on the continent. However, it's during his reign that Denmark begins to build up a significant fleet royal, for example. It's under Christian's son, Frederick II, who becomes king in 1559, that we see Denmark beginning to throw its weight around, and in a couple of capacities. One of them is as a power broker in northern Germany. Because Danish kings saw themselves also as German princes. They just happened to have the resources of a kingdom behind them, so they could play those territorial games a lot better than other German princes could. And Denmark will continue the next century to build up its base of client states and of its own territorial possessions in northern Germany. The other thing that Frederick II does is get involved in European religious wars and in politics of the Holy Roman Empire, and then in these attempts that center. It's very well known for Elizabeth I of England. It's not so well known for Frederick II. These attempts at center really on England and Denmark and the Netherlands to create kind of a Protestant international, if you will, following the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent within the history of the Catholic Church is, you know, I'm sure you know, is a major point of consolidation to recover from the damages inflicted by the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah.
And the perception of the Catholic Church as aggressive, as unbent on destruction of Protestants, in fact, extermination of Protestants, is what compels these attempts at a Protestant alliance. They never really fully work out. But this is the concern that Frederick II has, is the creation of an alliance with the Dutch and the English and with German Protestants to combat what they see as Catholic aggression.
Okay, let's talk about several concepts that you brought up. You said Denmark throw its weight around, power broker, client states. Combat other nations. And as you were saying, using these terms, the whole while I was thinking, how did Denmark get the resources to do this? How did it rise to power? Could it be in something that you said earlier? You said king wielded more authority because of the church. Did all of a sudden the king become more authoritarian and could call up more Danish people to come and serving the army? I'm speculating there.
Well, that's definitely one aspect of it.
You know, okay.
The fact that the king does not quite have to kowtow to the aristocracy as had been the case before. Now that that dynamic is not gone entirely, because certainly Christian IV will have a lot of headbutting with his aristocracy during the 30 Years' War. But the king definitely has a lot more executive authority where it comes to, for example, building a fleet. Although generally speaking, aristocrats weren't opposed to fleets. They didn't see fleets as something that would that could be used as an instrument of royalist oppression, right?
Arms yeah.
can do that, not so much fleets. Fleets are kind of safe. And fleets yeah. are good for commerce, right? So there's that. But the other thing is, Denmark is really at this point beginning to profit in a very big way from its wonderful geopolitical situation. Because this is really the key to understanding Denmark as a great power. It controls the Sound. It controls all the maritime passages between the North Sea and the Baltic. In particular, because it controls the southern part of Sweden and, of course, controls the Danish islands. And any ship passing from the North Sea into the Baltic is either going to have to go through one of the so-called belts, which are even more restrictive, between the Danish islands, or through the Sound, which is the narrow passage between present-day Sweden and Denmark. All you have to do is put a few forts on either side of the Sound, and you've closed it off.
Yeah.
The Danish kings learn that they can control the Baltic trade, which is arguably one of the most important trade routes, if not, certainly the most important in Northern Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. And this is where most of Northern European grain comes from Poland and East Prussia and from Muscovy. So the Danish kings learn they can turn on and turn off the Baltic trade as if they had their hand on a faucet. The couple of things about that, first of all, of course, it kind of forces them into having to play a role in international politics, because unless you want to just leave the Sound open, every European state that does business in the Baltic is going to be jealous of you or court your support. And this leads to, a lot of confrontations with the English, with the Dutch, even with the Spanish, yeah. for example.
Had armadas, had their own yes. merchant ships and armadas. Yeah.
Yes. And Denmark did too. It kind of had to at this point. I mean, I think it's arguable that by 1570, 1580, the Danish fleet was the equivalent of the Elizabethan fleet.
Oh, wow.
In size and in sophistication. It doesn't get a lot of press, but Denmark is up there at the top of Northern European naval powers.
So it
remained that way really through the 17th century. I'm sorry to interrupt. I want to make my second point before I forget it. The other thing, of course, that comes from control of the Baltic is that the Danish kings quickly decide to turn this into a money-making venture. And so we have the so-called Sound dues, which are collected from the end of the 15th century until the 1850s. So that any ship passing through the Sound at Helsinger, what most English speakers know as Elsinore, where Hamlet takes place in Shakespeare's
play. Oh, interesting.
The Kronborg Castle at Helsinger is where those dues are collected. They vary from time to time. Some nations pay more, some nations pay less. Some sensitive goods like gunpowder, for example, might demand a pretty high fee. But this money goes directly to the king's coffers, not to Denmark's, but to the king's. And it means that Danish kings have a tremendous amount of wherewithal. Christian IV, king of Denmark from 1596 to 1648, the king during the 30 Years' War, is generally considered to be the wealthiest individual sovereign in all of Europe in terms of his access to cash reserves coming from the Sound dues. So in other words, they not only are forced into a confrontational position with other European powers, they have cash, lots and lots of cash.
Again, the king, the monarch, or herself. And yes. I could see how aristocrats wouldn't really care much about that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not coming. So how did it all fall apart? How did it decline? I mean, I know it's several hundred years of history, but I'm just curious here.
Well, it happens in a flash, though. I mean, it really does happen in a flash.
In a flash, okay.
I think Denmark was, you could make the argument that in 1600, Denmark is Europe's leading Protestant state, period. I mean, I realize that that probably ticks off a bunch of Tudor historians or Stuart yeah. historians, but you just pay much attention to diplomatic interchange at the time. The king of Denmark is well, Denmark is accorded a significance and a degree of power that we don't see any other time in its history, but definitely is in the front rank, seen as the leading Protestant power. And so when Christian IV goes to war in 1625 in the 30 Years' War, he's regarded as kind of a natural champion for the Protestant cause. But, you know, flash forward to 1645, and Denmark is already looking like it has been, and its position has been...
Wait, from 1625 to 1645?
Yeah. And reasons for that. First of all, Denmark's defeat in the 30 Years' War, because it is defeated, does set the monarchy back somewhat. It also creates a situation where the king and his aristocracy are somewhat at loggerheads. There's definitely a constitutional crisis going on in Denmark in the 1630s and 1640s. In the meantime, Sweden, you know, a lot of this has to do with Sweden rather than Denmark. Sweden has moved up in terms of its potential for wielding power dramatically and kind of quietly. Sweden had been on its own since the 1520s and had been fighting for its life against a slew of enemies that surrounded it. Muscovy, Poland, Denmark, the Hanseatic League occasionally, and with virtually no wherewithal. I mean, Sweden was a poor country, period.
Yeah.
Very little resources. But among other things, you know, the Swedes not only developed a certain hardness and toughness, I think, that was that contemporaries remarked about a lot. It was Count Waldeck that said something, I can't remember the exact quote, but the Swedes are a cold and hungry people. The Swedes are a hungry people, and consequently, they are cold and hard-hearted. there's that, learning how to make do with very little. But also under Gustavus Adolphus, I mean, it's become fashionable, I think, to minimize what Gustavus Adolphus manages to accomplish. But, you know, Swedish military institutions go from being, you know, capable of holding off the Poles mostly to a world-class fighting force, both at sea and on land.
Yeah, we actually had an episode about the history of Sweden, and it's amazing how, with limited resources, they essentially became an empire for several decades, and in a flash themselves also.
And with a unity between king and ruling class that Denmark doesn't have at the same time, which is a huge disadvantage for Denmark.
I didn't follow that. Say that again, please.
Okay, in Sweden, there is a unity between king and ruling elite.
Okay,
that doesn't exist in Denmark.
Yes, yes.
And so it's even when Gustavus Adolphus is gone, even when it's Axel Oxenstierna as acting as regent for Queen Christina, even when it's Queen Christina ruling by herself, you know, there is a unity of purpose there, a shared mission between the monarchy and the aristocracy that we don't see in Denmark.
Yeah.
And Christian IV, he overextended himself. I mean, there's definitely that. One thing I pointed out, the money issue, of course, that the Danes certainly had the cash resources to hire mercenary armies and to build a navy. But Denmark doesn't really have a lot else. I mean, it's a reasonably prosperous rural economy. Farming is better in Denmark than it is in Norway or Sweden. It doesn't really have a lot of natural resources per se. I mean, the silver and iron resources at Kongsberg, for example, in Norway haven't really been developed significantly, and they're not as good as what Sweden has. The one advantage, and it was an advantage that Denmark had, is one of the few European states that could make its own gunpowder without having to import anything, because through Iceland, it had one of the largest supplies of sulfur in the world.
So
the Danes don't have to import anything to make gunpowder, which is good.
Yeah.
But basically, Denmark does not have the sinews of a great power and a small population. I mean, if you count all the lands under the rule of the Oldenburg kings at the height of its power, you're looking what, maybe 1.25 million. Total.
Oh my goodness. Wow. That is tiny.
Yeah.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about religion and religious wars. which we mentioned in the earlier segment. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Lockhart, I have several questions about religion in Denmark. The first question, simple one, I just want to know, you mentioned this, if you would remind me, please, when did Denmark adopt Christianity?
Well, formally 1536, 1537. Christianity. I'm sorry. I'm thinking way ahead of you chronologically.
That goes to the heart of my question. I know how you're about to clarify it. Go ahead. You're referring to a Protestantism, right?
Yes.
There you go.
Lutheranism in particular, but Lutheranism. Catholic Christianity. That's under the reign of Harald Blåtand, who probably better known for a variety of reasons should become obvious as Harold Bluetooth. Where we get the name of the technology. In fact.
Really?
That comes from that. Yes. So Harold Bluetooth converted to Catholic Christianity, and
when was that?
This would have been late in the 10th century that he manages that. Denmark is pretty thoroughly Christianized by the end of his reign. A good relationship with the church, one that didn't necessarily pay off immediately in political dividends to Harold, but by and large it was a boon. I mean, it gave him connections with the Holy Roman Emperor and with the papacy and its power and wealth that the Danes did not have while they were pagans.
Okay. I have just a curious fun question to ask here.
Yes.
If you said the Bluetooth technology came from Harold, the Bluetooth's name, what's the connection?
I'm trying to remember what it is. It's come up in a few news stories. If you Google it, you'll see it.
I will actually include it.
I would have looked it up myself before.
No, that's just fascinating. That. Really funny. So let's go to Denmark's Christianization. I'm not talking about how it became Protestant, Lutheran specifically,
right,
in the 16th century. I'm going back to the 10th century. When Harold the Bluetooth became Christian, and then during his reign, Denmark was thoroughly Christianized.
Yes.
When you say that, what does that mean? How does a population go from being pagans to being Christian? Is that, you read about these stories of how Charlemagne brutalized people and pagans and Christianized them, and that's how the Pope loved Charlemagne and all of that. Is that how it is, or was... Were Christian missionaries already in Denmark?
Christian missionaries already in Denmark, and I think overall, I mean, this is at least the evidence doesn't seem to suggest a great deal of intimidation or force.
Okay,
that this was readily accepted. So it's pretty smooth. I don't where it comes to the mechanics, say at the level of the individual missionary, I couldn't tell you with great detail.
You answered my question. My question was essentially about that, whether or not it was a state sort of forced process, or is this just sort of smoothly happened?
Well, Harold definitely gives his imprimatur on this, and it's something that was very important to him personally. Mm-hmm. But it seems to have been taken up within a generation or two, pretty quickly. And I'd say it's probably less traumatic than the. At least some aspects of the Protestant Reformation.
You've written a book titled Frederick II and the Protestant Cause, Denmark's Role in the Wars of Religion, 1559 to 1596. This book's period identified in the title sort of caught my attention, because I know of the 30-year war. We discussed it in the last period, which sort of began the decline of Denmark. It entered the war in 1625 with all sorts of promises and glory. Yeah. And then by 1645, it already was sort of a has-been.
Yeah.
So I know about the 30-year war to some extent. I don't know what you mean by religious wars of 1559 to 1596.
I'm talking about the civil wars that become international wars, primarily in France and the Netherlands. So in France, it'd be the so-called wars of religion that start with the death of King Henry II in 1559. Probably the most famous episode from that is the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in August of 1572.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, you know, there's multiple French wars of religion until Henry IV proclaims the Edict of Nantes and Protestantism is tolerated. We go back to more religious wars in the early 17th century during the time of Richelieu. But the period that's most fraught is a period from the early 1560s to the late 1580s, where the French monarchy is actively trying to establish its primacy within France at the same time that it's dealing with both contentious Catholic nobles and with the Huguenots, you know, with French Protestants who are struggling for survival.
And this had international reverberations. Like reading about Elizabeth I, they were worried about these wars and all the persecution of the Huguenots who were going to England, actually.
Yes.
So how does Denmark...
This is part of a big Catholic papal conspiracy. I mean, that's typical of the age. You know, it's not just a matter of a domestic issue. This is part of the agenda of the King of Spain and the Pope and to exterminate Protestants.
So how does Denmark play a role in all of this?
Well, Frederick II very much bought into that belief, and that partly came from the fact that, unlike his father, he was very interested in continental politics and deliberately immersed himself in German politics, for example. He had close relationships with a number of German Protestant princes, and he believed, too, and of course he saw evidence of this within his own land.
He believed what, in the Reformation cause?
Believed in the idea that there is a Catholic conspiracy to subjugate Protestant Europe. The language sounds a lot like domino theory when it comes to communism during the Cold War. You know, if France falls, then it's going to be the Netherlands. Then it's going to be the Protestant German states. Then it's going to be us. You know. So we better stop them now.
It wasn't immediately affecting his realm, his immediate realm, but this was sort of preemptive.
Yeah, yeah. And understand, too, that, you know, again, this is getting into the complexities of late 16th century diplomacy, which is why I love dealing with. The overall perception that, especially because it's very easy for Lutherans to portray the Pope as the Antichrist, for Catholics to portray people like John Calvin or Martin Luther as the Antichrist. This feeling that we are living on the edge of the actual apocalypse, that this is the end of days, and that opposing force is in fact the forces of the Antichrist, and you better be on the right side, right? when we're looking at the end of time.
Do you appreciate how crazy it sounds when you say they called the Pope the Antichrist?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. All right. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Lockhart as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Lockhart, how do Danes view their own history now?
It was a really interesting question. It was something that was kind of a surprise to me when I first started going to Denmark to do work there. And a very interesting conversation I had with a owner of an antiquarian book dealer in Odense. And I was trying to find a bunch of obscure volumes dealing with 16th and 17th century financial history. And he said, I'm curious, you're an American. why would you find any of this interesting? The interesting history is where you live. And you know, there's this, and I found this again and again, except from professional historians in Denmark, is they really didn't think their history was all that interesting.
Really?
There was that. Now, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of Danes who find their history to be interesting. And the fact that there are so many physical reminders, for example, of Christian IV. You go on Copenhagen, there's a building that was designed by Christian IV or built under his reign, you know, practically every street corner. Yeah. But nothing wistful, nothing really sentimental. Even where it comes to the
I'm surprised, the
collapse of empire, because the Danes had, besides their early modern empire, they did have kind of a scattered 19th, 20th century empire, the Danish Virgin, Danish West Indies, the Virgin Islands, of course.
Yeah.
Plus colonies in Sri Lanka and in Africa. The fact that Denmark was once an imperial power like other European states is no more of a matter of, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm mean, nothing, no, no, no wistful yearning for a day when Denmark was great. And
does that surprise you?
I guess not in the context of 1864. And the year 1864 is such tremendous repercussions for Danish society, culture, and politics. Incidentally, I don't know if you run into the Danish miniseries, the most expensive production in Danish TV history came out a few years ago called 1864.
What is 1864?
The Second Schleswig War, the war between Denmark, Prussia, and Austria, the first of the German Wars of Unification, where Denmark was, taken down a really big notch by Bismarck's generals and by the Austrians. And lost a fair chunk of its territory in the southern part of Jutland, which some of which they got back in 1920 after a plebiscite after World War I. But 1864 was a big slap in the face and was a national humiliation, but also a very cold reminder that Denmark isn't all that anymore. We look back at this from the perspective of the 21st century, and it looks ridiculous. Why would Denmark actually go to war with Prussia and Austria? Well, in the perspective of 1864, it doesn't look that ridiculous. Denmark had a decent army. It wasn't very big. And its navy was definitely better than anything the Prussians or the Austrians could put together. Plus, the Danes really believed that the Swedes and the British would help them out. Of course, neither came to pass. But that 1864 moment is kind of the realization that we're a small state. We're a small, unimportant state. And that, from that point on, just the notion that Denmark was once a major power, regional or European, still is one that I think a lot of Danes don't quite accept.
Interesting.
Once it was a lot bigger.
Are there? I chuckle at the question I'm about to ask you, Dr. Lockhart, but I'll ask it anyway. Are there any lessons from Danish history for us Americans?
Well, I mean, there's one of the obvious ones, obviously, is the transience of power, right? I mean, granted, Denmark, the basis of power is a pretty fragile and tenuous one from the beginning, but just that notion that it is just as hard to believe that Denmark could have been a great power looking at from our perspective. I imagine it's pretty hard to imagine Danes not being able to concede that they wouldn't be a great power from the perspective of 1600. That's to me an important consideration. In a more contemporary political sense, to me, Denmark is a perfect example of why organizations like NATO actually serve a vital function in the world today.
Amen. Yeah.
Denmark, of course, has been a very eager and pretty dedicated member of NATO.
Yeah. Was it a founding member?
Pardon?
Was it a founding member?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. The fact though that. I mean, that it's hard to imagine a state like Denmark being able to survive without NATO acting in a way like Mac Walker once said about the Holy Roman Empire as an incubator.
yeah,
something that allows a lesser, you know, lesser states to survive and thrive. And Denmark's contributions to the world in terms of in culture and sciences and the arts are not insignificant.
Yeah, of course. Of course. If you wanted our audience to remember just one point about Denmark's history, after everything we've talked about, what would that be?
That's a really good question. I think and again, this is sort of perspective of an historian, that it's important for us to understand the past from the perspective of the past. And what I mean here in particular is that, you know, one of the reasons that we don't talk much about Danish history or that much about Swedish, if it weren't for Michael Roberts, nobody would talk about Swedish history at all. Yeah. Or Polish history, is that these are states that have as failed as great powers. And that, you know, I think to ignore that is to kind of skew our notion of how states and how societies expand and contract. If we were just to look at, you know, at European history, as so many of my predecessors have done, I think, in the field, from the viewpoint of England, France, Germany, or Britain, France,
yeah.
Germany.
Yeah.
That we have a hard time understanding as if this is a matter of fate, right? As if this is
as if it was inevitable, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Interesting.
And I think looking at failed states that sounds bad. And looking at failed powers,
yeah,
actually is one way of combating that.
That's a wonderful point to end our conversation, Dr. Lockhart. Thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.